Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, who remains in Guantanamo Detention Center and why? We'll discuss the history, the attempts to close Guantanamo, and what it has meant for the United States, for international law, and for the prisoners themselves. But first, a new book of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's correspondence reveals the politics of the past and how it has changed. Times have changed in Washington, marked by polarized politics and unfriendly rancor. The old school decorum has ostensibly faded. Among the senators who most exemplified the possibility of bipartisanship and big ideas was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the longshoreman turned scholar turned politician. A new book titled Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary, features one of his most prolific aspects, his letter-writing prowess. Through his letters, he shows a changing Congress and changing world. We have with us the author, a fellow and journalist, Stephen Weissman. Stephen Weissman is editorial director and public policy fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a former journalist at the New York Times and Time magazine. Welcome, Stephen Weissman.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Why don't we start with this kind of larger historical context of Senator Moynihan? The letters seem to paint this picture of a guy who was very bipartisan, who got along pretty much with everybody, worked with both sides. I mean, he's the guy who brought Ralph Nader in to Washington, defended him to the core, and yet worked for Richard Nixon. How do we explain this?
It's hard to explain, but one of the things we learn from these letters is from his diaries, his very early diaries in the 1950s, and these letters go from the 1950s all the way into the 21st century, is that he came from a broken family. His father abandoned him, his family, when Pat Moynihan was only 10, and he never saw him again. He had a feel for impoverished families that were broken, and that became his signature issue all through his career. But it led to something else, I believe, which is that he believed in the institution of government and the stability of government. His whole career was a search for stability, both in his family and in politics. And this led him to hope and support that presidents, even those with whom he disagreed and who were on from the other side of the aisle, should succeed. And that led him, as a lifelong Democrat, to work for Richard Nixon in the hope, which he later believed was somewhat naive, that Richard Nixon could find a new center for American politics at a time of maximum instability, when there were riots in the cities, there were riots on campuses, there was poisonous racial and generational and cultural divisions. He wanted the presidency to succeed.
When we look at this man, and he, you said he then thought maybe he was a little bit naive, but he did seem to have some traction with Nixon.
Oh, he did. You know, one of the things that comes across in these letters is a Nixon that I think a lot of people, certainly your listeners, certainly myself, didn't recognize. But Nixon, in a way, was an intellectual. He's a soldier in the Cold War. He was anti-communist to the core in his early career, which was here in Southern California. Moynihan appealed to his intellectual interests. Moynihan could say to him, you know, what you're trying to do, Mr. President, is similar to what Benjamin Disraeli tried to do in the 19th century British politics, which is engage in social reforms, but as a conservative. And he tried to appeal to Nixon's almost, you might say, intellectual vanity. And Nixon went ahead and read biographies of Benjamin Disraeli and became fascinated
at the urging of Moynihan.
And their relationship, which comes out in these letters, is utterly fascinating. It's different from anything I understood existed before. And when Nixon was ousted and forced out after Watergate in the mid-1970s, Moynihan was ambassador to India, and he gives a wonderful address to the employees of the American Embassy, where he says, look, this man committed impeachable offenses. He had to go. But we who serve in government should remember that Nixon has now become the third president in a row ousted from office or violently taken from office. Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson was ousted by an uprising over the war. Nixon now was impeached. Moynihan said, this is something we should think about because we have to be concerned with the legitimacy of government and government institutions. And I think those words speak to us now so powerfully.
One of the other things I think it captured was that even though there was strong line between liberals and conservatives or Democrats and Republicans, or however that might be articulated, there was this ability to bridge during that time that doesn't seem to be quite so present anymore.
I think you're right. Moynihan sort of had a tribal view of politics. He was from the tribe of Irish Catholic Democrats in New York, grew up in Hell's Kitchen, where everything was going to be determined by whether you were from the Jewish tribe or the Irish tribe or the Italian tribe.
Well, that's right. He wrote about ethnicity as a scholar.
It was his first subject, and when he collaborated with Nathan Glaser, the great Harvard sociologist, on Beyond the Melting Pot, which came out in the early 60s, which understood that ethnicity was the basis of American politics in the cities. And he also, by the way, later understood that it was the basis for national politics all around the world in the Balkans.
International wars.
So he understood that from a variety of perspectives. But there was another aspect of his tribal politics. It's a little different. He understood that politicians themselves were kind of part of a tribe. They understood that the person they were fighting with one day was going to have to be somebody that they'd have to collaborate with the next day. And when you're in a tribe in the Senate or in the House and you have to work with people and get the votes where you can, that reintroduces a sense of civility and even a sense of humor and perspective into politics that we've tended to forget must exist today, where everything is warfare and determined by, if I may say, the exaggerated, almost cartoon-like depictions that you hear too much on cable TV or wherever.
His time was a time when people could be more accommodating for the other side, I think. But it was also partly who he was. I wonder, are there Moynihans today?
I think not, but I like to think that even on both sides, there are those who believed first and foremost in looking at the facts. And Moynihan, one of his signature sayings is, everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. Of course, what we now have is people who look not only at opinions and facts, but they look at narratives. You know, they selectively look at facts and they put together a narrative. And that's where our politics have gone, sometimes not to the benefit of our political system. There's hardly anyone on the scene like Pat Moynihan today. You know, when he first ran for office in 1976, his opponent tried to belittle him by calling him Professor Moynihan in all their debates and in all his appearances. And Moynihan's response was, well, the mudslinging has begun. So he had a kind of ironic sense of humor, almost, you know, able to diffuse the bitterness of politics. That's also an awfully rare commodity.
I want to go back to Nixon for just a minute.
Sure.
Because one of the letters I thought was pretty remarkable when he said, you know, he had defended Nixon. And he asks, was I a fool or was I a whore or both?
Such a powerful letter. He wrote that as Watergate was sinking the Nixon presidency, and he was sent off to India to be ambassador, which was one of the more interesting, trying, and challenging periods of his life. I lived in India for 3.5 years, and I must say I have a personal love of the letters from India, because while he was engaging in these ethnic issues in India, he was also looking from thousands of miles away from the other side of the globe at this presidency. And he was writing to his best friend, Nathan Glaser, with whom he collaborated on the Beyond the Melting Pot book. And he used those words. Aren't they amazing? I mean, I really felt in doing this book, I knew Pat Moynihan, but I learned something about him as I took this journey through the decades of his career, which was also a journey through the second half of the 20th century, really, of American politics, which was that he was much more anguished, much more hurt, much more proud and self-aware and self-referential than could be understood with his many books and public utterances. You can see through these letters this evolution of his personal passions, but you can also see that the scars and the hurts, and he did feel in the Nixon years, as Nixon was running into the ground, that his own reputation was ruined. It's amazing how it comes across in his personal writings.
His life seems to exemplify several things. One is that American success story from started with
remarkable.
His broken family,
yeah.
And then, you know, became a longshoreman and then became a scholar and then into politics. And so he really is kind of
very unusual.
A poster child of a success story from very humble roots. But there are a few other things that I kind of captured in this. One is it's both a story of how one person can make a difference and at the same time a story of how hard it is to make a difference.
Well, Pat Moynihan used to say, if you're not willing to put 20 or 30 years into something, to trying to get something enacted, then you don't belong in politics. He worked patiently on issues over a long period of time. He started in the early 1960s writing to Lyndon Johnson about the plight of the African-American family, the Negro family, as he called it in his famous Moynihan report. But it wasn't until the late 1980s that he really brought about changes in the welfare system that he had started to try and bring about. And he spectacularly failed in the Nixon years when they tried to put through the Family Assistance Plan. His career is a testimony to, yes, as you say, kind of up from humble beginnings, but it is also as a testimony to persistence and patience. There's another example of that, which is some of the urban renewal projects, like in Pennsylvania Avenue, which again started in the early 1960s and ended up in the 1990s being completed. And if you've been to Washington today and you see Pennsylvania Avenue with the Willard Hotel and the Ronald Reagan Building all spiffed up and looking great, there's a little place on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's called Daniel Patrick Moynihan Place, just to signal his role in a project like that, which took 25, 30 years to bring to fruition.
Now, if we fast forward his work to the Clinton, he was immensely disappointed in Bill Clinton, it seemed, particularly with the health care bill.
They tangled on that, yes. They had a difference of priorities. Shortly after Clinton took office, Moynihan went on Meet the Press, which was hosted by Tim Russert, who had worked for Pat as a press secretary, and said, there's no health care crisis in this country, which was exactly the opposite of what the White House was saying. That was not a particularly good relationship. They tangled. He tangled with Hillary Clinton. In the end,
he endorsed her.
He endorsed her and really helped to anoint her. And on election night in 2000, the famous Bush v. Gore night, Bill Clinton turned to Pat Moynihan and said, without your endorsement, she wouldn't have won.
Let me remind our listeners that we're speaking with Stephen Wiseman, and the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary. You know, I think this array of letters shows us the inner workings of government and inner workings of relationships. And you go way back into, I think this was an RFK letter where he talks about J. Edgar Hoover was who it was.
Oh,
who
yes,
would send
yes.
these photographs.
Incriminating information about Martin Luther King, I think. And
the one memo was about J. Edgar Hoover sending regular reports about RFK's sex life just to show they were watching him.
Yeah.
Tells us a lot about how Washington works, I think.
You know, Pat Moynihan had a very bad relationship with the FBI and the CIA. In 1979, Pat Moynihan predicted that the Soviet Union would fall. That was a good more than a decade before it fell. An amazing example of his ability to prophesy things before they happen. Going back to the early 1950s, actually, there's a great letter where when he was a student in London, he had a Fulbright. And he's very concerned because he's been told that there have been intelligence reports that he might be cavorting with communists. And of course, if you were a student in London in the early 1950s, you would there was a pretty strong left wing and a labor movement which had communist elements in it. So he really felt that red baiting, he really hated red baiting throughout his career. And it made him very unsympathetic to the FBI. So he takes note of that with Bobby Kennedy, just in signaling to him in that letter that you mentioned, watch out for Hoover. Watch out for the FBI. It's a really great little moment there.
It actually makes the dark side of Washington kind of appear in little tiny pieces.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and also Moynihan's relationship with the Kennedys. As I say in my introduction, you know, there's a certain generation, and I would include myself in this, for whom, you know, John F. Kennedy really pulled the sword from the stone. That was what Camelot was all about. It's hard to imagine. I guess there was a little bit of that in 2008 with the early idealism about President Obama. But for Kennedy, it just hit the country and it hit the generation that Moynihan was in. And the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963 was so devastating to that generation and to Pat Moynihan, whose words on that occasion still echo and are still moving. And there are these letters and transcripts of his comments then. He was only an obscure assistant secretary of labor, but when in an interview he said, "I don't suppose there's any point in being Irish if you don't know the world is going to break your heart. I just thought we had more time." That couple of sentences really still sends chills through me because it's so moving. And Pat Moynihan's eloquence in public, but also in these letters, it really comes to life.
When you look at the book in whole now, from beginning to end, what do you think it tells us about the policymaking process and how it's changed?
I think it tells you how complicated and how much patience you need. But it also, I think Moynihan's signal contribution is something that was also an amazing discovery in these letters. In the 1980s, he gave some lectures at Harvard. And then in the last month of his life, when it seems to me he understood that the end was near, because he was sick for quite some period in and out of hospitals, he writes, "In 40 years of government service, I've learned one thing, and that is that the conservative axiom of American politics is that culture, not politics, determines the success of a society, but that the liberal truth is that politics can save a culture from itself." And then he says something really important, which runs through his career and really is the answer to your question, which is that these two truths together strengthen our society. As he writes, I think, "They may have made us a stronger country than we would have otherwise been." And I think that after this toxic period that we've gone through, where it's been so divisive and we're so appalled at the fury of disagreement, I think the one contribution Pat Moynihan might have made to this debate is, hey, look, this is the way we debate things. We've been debating the role of government since Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. This is not bad for us to do. This is good for us to do. How else are we going to solve these our problems except by having these debates? But he would also say they should be based on facts.
Right. Well, great. I think that's a perfect place to end. Stephen Weissman, thank you so much for coming in. Again, the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait and Letters of an American Visionary. It's a collection of his letters.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun to talk to you.
Thank you. When we come back, who remains in Guantanamo Detention Center and why? We'll discuss the history, the attempts to close Guantanamo, and what it has meant for the United States, for international law, and for the prisoners themselves. Stay tuned.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Closing the Guantanamo Bay detention facility was one of Barack Obama's campaign promises. In 2009, as one of his first acts, he decreed that Guantanamo be closed within a year. 7 years later, the president has finally ramped up his efforts to make good on his campaign promise in his final few months of office. What are the obstacles now, and what has it meant for the United States, for international law, and for the detainees themselves to have left this issue unresolved for so long? Joining us are three experts. David Glazer is a professor of law at Loyola Law School. His publications include Destined for an Epic Fail, the problematic Guantanamo military commissions, and the misuse of history, conspiracy, and the Guantanamo military commissions. Peter Jan Honigsberg is professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. He's the founder and director of the Witness Guantanamo Project and the author of Our Nation Unhinged, The Human Consequences of the War on Terror and Crossing Border Street, a Civil Rights Memoir. Also with us is Jonathan Hafitz. He's a human rights lawyer and a professor at Seton Hall Law School. He's the author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and he's co-editor of The Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have the three of you back here with us again to update about what has been happening with Guantanamo Bay, the prisoners that have been detained there, and also around the realm of human rights and civil rights law pertaining to this and what it has meant for the United States. We should start with the basics. I think there were originally around 800 prisoners. The last time the three of you were with us, there were about 166, I think. So perhaps we should start with where we are now and what has happened over the past two-ish, three-ish years. Peter, let's start with you. Peter Honigsberg.
Well, we're down to 80 prisoners, and President Obama wants to close Guantanamo. He says he does, and apparently he's trying, but the months are running out, and he's hoping by holding these board hearings to basically allow as many men as possible to become cleared so that they can be freed and transferred to other countries. Many of them have been, but there's still many that are not cleared, and many of them possibly indefinite prisoners and could actually continue to stay in Guantanamo. There's some talk about moving the prisoners to the U.S., but Congress is blocking that. The president possibly could do it on his own, which we can have a conversation about, but that is, in a nutshell, what is going on at the present time. I'm sure John and David could fill in a lot more details on the law, but if you wanted a quick summary, it is.
I also wanted to get a bit more on your Guantanamo project. You've been to the prison, and I think also Jonathan has, and you've written a pretty detailed description of what you saw. Could you relay what you've seen and what your project has revealed about Guantanamo Bay?
What I saw in 2007 has changed dramatically. I think President Obama has made Guantanamo quite similar, and this is actually depressing, to a prison in the U.S. Just the maximum security of the prison is not all that different. There are some differences, of course. The prisons are very different, but essentially Guantanamo, in fact, when we interviewed just yesterday, made the same correlation, is not all that different from a maximum security prison in the U.S. So people who know anything about how prisoners in the U.S. are held in isolation often for 22 or 23 or 24 hours, some of the prisoners in Guantanamo are as well. There are some maximum security cells in Guantanamo. Some people have where they can meet during the days. But it's not all that different from what we know in America, actually. It has changed a lot with the administration.
Jonathan Hafitz, I wonder if we could bring you in here, too. You've been involved with some of the lawsuits. You've co-edited the book about the lawyers. You've also written a bit about the torture culture. What have you seen in contrast with what Peter just described?
I've seen very similar things to Peter. I think there's been a slow attrition in the population of Guantanamo. I think, fortunately, though, there was a lot of lost time. There were a period from around 2011 to 2013 when virtually no one was released from the prison. I think the Obama administration has tried to step up its plan to transfer detainees as the, you know, as his time in office ends, and he has not fulfilled a promise that he frequently made about closing the prison. And I think this is for him, a kind of a legacy issue. But ultimately, I think that his policy has been one of filled with contradictions, I think, or his approach. I think he's promised to close the prison, yet he maintained several key features of the Guantanamo Detention Center, including military commissions and law indefinite detention, which have made it harder to close the prison. And I think there's just been far too much delay in transferring prisoners whom the administration has cleared for release. They're really trying to focus on those people now, the administration through its interagency process has determined doesn't pose a significant threat to the United States. But many of these people have been known about since Obama came into office, did their first review of the prisoners, and a lot of them just sat in Guantanamo for years. So I just think it's been too slow. And I think the likelihood is that they're going to remain, there'll be some further reduction in the prison population, but Obama's going to leave office with Guantanamo still there.
Before we move into this entire process and the legal issues associated with it, Jonathan Hafetz, I wanted to incorporate this other thing that you have looked at. You wrote about the rendition process, the U.S.'s global detention system. How does Guantanamo fit into this, and what exactly have you found with your research there?
It's interesting. I think Guantanamo, in a sense, is kind of, it's in a sense of a relic, but something that's of a prior, a product of prior policies, yet there are elements of it that are still relevant to current policies. Let me just explain a little bit more. I think that the United States has made a concerted effort to avoid remaining in the business of long-term terrorism detentions outside of the criminal justice system. Obama closed the end of the CIA detention program. The United States has handed over all the remaining prisoners who are at the Bagram facility in Afghanistan to Afghan authority. And in a sense, Guantanamo is like a relic where these people who were picked up and held as part of the war on terror under Bush are still there, still being held and still being held under the same legal regime. That said, and those numbers are going down. But that said, the Guantanamo still remains. And because it remains, the system and the legal architecture is still in place for these kind of long-term detentions. So if the United States were to start detaining individuals, let's say captured in the conflict with ISIS or ISIL or some other overseas counterterrorism operation, the United States might well move them to Guantanamo. I don't think that will happen. I'm almost certain it won't happen under this administration because it just would contradict the Obama administration's plan to close the prison. But it still certainly could happen under, you know, a new administration, depending who takes office in the next election. In a sense, Guantanamo is this kind of waning feature of the war on terror that the Bush administration launched after the 9/11 attacks and are dwindling down, but it's also sort of there and could be, in a sense, reused and reemerge as a place for holding prisoners and a place the United States wants to keep open under a different administration. And that may help explain, in fact, some of the resistance of the Defense Department, which is really, in a sense, fought to Obama's plan to efforts to close the prison.
David Glazier, let's bring you in to talk about some of these legal aspects. And you've also analyzed a lot of the proceedings. How do you see this?
Well, I think I agree with everything that we've heard from Jonathan and Peter. It's just appallingly slow. So back in 2013, President Obama issued an order directing that everyone remaining at Guantanamo who wasn't either in the military commission process or had been already cleared for release was to get a formal hearing within 1 year. And we are now more than 3 years later, and a substantial number of the folks are still waiting for that first hearing. So it's tempting to put the blame on folks like Congress for making it difficult to transfer people out of Guantanamo. But the reality is that the President of the United States issued an order to people who work for him that has been totally blown off, and there's been absolutely no accountability for that.
Why is it that that has happened? What has been the thing that is stopping it?
The information really isn't out there for those of us in the public without inside connections to really know with any certainty. I have heard folks involved with the process indicate that the reviews that are taking place are being done at a very high level. In other words, it's an interagency process. It requires a senior individual from six different parts of the executive branch, including with the State Department, the Justice Department, the CIA, the Department of Defense, to sign off on the release. In other words, no one is approved or put in the release category unless there's unanimous agreement among these six representatives. Apparently, one of the problems is that it's being done at such a high level that it's difficult to schedule these hearings, and they require a lot of formal preparation. But, you know, if that was the case, certainly there are things that could have been done. You could have moved it down to a lower level. You could schedule multiple hearings at the same time so that you get through it faster. You know, there really is no excuse when the President of the United States tells the executive branch that this is what they are required to do in a written executive order. They are supposed to comply.
Peter Honigsberg, who are the detainees that are still in Guantanamo prison, and why are they the last ones to be processed? What do we know about them?
Well, we know that a majority of them are from Yemen, and that's because until recently, President Obama had a hold on any Yemeni detainee to be released. And so most of the people that were released were not Yemeni, and those who were left are. And they cannot be sent back to Yemen because Yemen is a failed state at the moment. And so they have to find countries for these men. And unfortunately, a lot of countries that were taking people at one point over the last 15 years are no longer interested in taking any people. And so the U.S. is giving money to countries to take them, and often it's the poor countries that are taking them, and some Arab countries also taking them, but it's a slow process, and many countries are just not interested, and consequently these men just sit there. And so there's 26, I believe, people who are cleared for release who are just sitting there because the U.S. claims that they have found countries for them, but we haven't heard anything, and so they're not released. And I will tell you that we interviewed someone who was a Yemeni in Slovakia last year, and he told us that, this is really depressing, that I may be living in Slovakia, but I still live in Guantanamo because essentially Slovakia does not provide many services. Most of these poor countries don't. They don't provide counseling. They don't provide much health services, social services, and he gets $15 a day for food. He gets substandard housing, and as a consequence, one of the things that is worth noting for your program is that a lot of people who are released, who are transferred, actually don't necessarily go to a better state. A lot of them are still living in a situation that reminds them of Guantanamo, and no one's looking out for them. The U.S. has washed its hands of them, except for national security issues, and so they are left on their own devices, and they don't have any resources to take care of it. So there's lots of serious problems, both in the transfer and in the people who are left in terms of not being transferred. And I will add something that David said. That's really important. I think what David said, and the implication is there, but I think people need to understand that President Obama is at fault here to me. And perhaps David is saying that too. I feel really strongly that, as David said, the executive has the authority to tell his staff to do the right thing. And he apparently didn't do it. And apparently it has been like that for 7 years of his administration. At the early his administration, he had a Democratic Congress. He could have closed Guantanamo. Then he claims the Republicans have stopped him. We don't have time to know the details, but I do think it lays at the doorstep of the president. He had the authority to do it. And as David pointed out, in many different ways, he didn't execute it.
Jonathan Hafetz, do you agree?
I largely agree. I mean, I do think that Congress, on the point of closure, bears responsibility, a good deal of responsibility. I think if Obama, there had been no political friction, I do think Obama would have closed the prison, but I think he could have done more in a lot of different ways and has not been aggressive. And Obama himself acknowledged as much when he realized, he said, look, I should have done this in my first year or even first few months and not waited. I guess I had 2 points just to add. One is that on closure, my view is that simply, you know, closing the prison, though, and moving the remaining detainees to the United States would not have been, you know, that would have just been moving the problem to a different location. I mean, that ending Guantanamo means closing the prison and either releasing the prisoners who are going to be released or trying the remaining prisoners who you believe are suspected of terrorism and trying them in a regular court, not a military court. I mean, I think that as demonstrated by the, you know, the last number of years where the U.S. has not been rounding up prisoners, the existing system works perfectly well, that we simply don't need to be detaining people for years without charges. And so I think that closing Guantanamo is close it. You need to charge prisoners in a federal court, a regular court, or release them. You know, I think the military commissions have been an unmitigated disaster. They've, you know, are botching the most important terrorism trial in the history of the country, that of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind. There's no question that if he had been brought to federal court and tried, he'd have been convicted and sentenced many years ago. His case is still a long way away from trial because it's in the military commission system. And I think, you know, indefinite detention, notion of holding people for 14 years as part of this long war, is just simply immoral and in my view, illegal, although some may disagree about that. And I guess the other thing is, I think Peter makes a very important point about redress. There's really been no effort at rehabilitation. There's been no compensation. That's a whole other subject for individuals who've been subjected to abusive treatment or illegal detention. And so I think this is that applies to Guantanamo as well as other parts of the 9/11, you know, detention and interrogation apparatus. I should say that, if I may, that there's a second volume of the stories of the lawyers is coming out next month called Obama's Guantanamo: Stories from an Enduring Prison. And there's a very powerful story in there by an attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights talking about the difficulties that detainees have adapting to the life where they've been given no support, and then talks about detainees in Albania who've been facing those problems.
I want to go back to that, but you also mentioned the lawyers and what they were facing, and we've had some of them on this program as well. I understand what they are dealing with and even seeing their clients. How would you describe that whole process for the lawyers?
The levels of secrecy and the ability, you could take notes, but they have to be, you know, they have to go through a special classification review, is, you know, an obstacle. The fact that Guantanamo is so difficult to get to, that you can't speak to prisoners by phone generally, those are all obstacles. I mean, in that sense, it's really, there's no reason for it. And it's much easier to be dealing with a client and representing a client who's in the federal system. I mean, I think those are just unnecessary obstacles. I also think, though, that the law has gotten so twisted, and the courts have, especially the Court of Appeals in D.C., which handles all the Guantanamo appeals, has really made the habeas corpus process, has put so many bars in the way or obstacles in the way of the habeas corpus process, that I think most lawyers feel actually at this point the courts really can do very, very little. And so it's strange to be, you know, representing clients where there's not much you can offer them in the way of legal process. And I think the clients don't have a lot of faith at this point that the legal system is going to do much for them. So in a way, I think a lot of what the lawyers are doing is either doing advocacy, other forms of advocacy, trying to advocate with the government or trying to persuade countries to accept their clients, and just simply being there as support for their clients, moral support for individuals who the law has given very little to and who've been locked up for almost 15 years in many cases now. So it's odd. I think it challenges the notion of what lawyers do, and I think lawyers have been forced to, by the system, to adapt to very different roles than what the ordinary course of action is for a lawyer.
David Glazer, what would you add?
Well, it's interesting. The defense authorization bill that's currently being worked on Capitol Hill has a radical new provision in it. It proposes to allow Guantanamo detainees to plead guilty in a federal court via video teleconference. So this is kind of strange because the law prohibits moving the detainees from Guantanamo to the United States to go into a courtroom and have a trial. But it appears that this would give the government the option to go ahead and charge these folks in a regular federal court, put them on a video teleconference in Guantanamo with the understanding that they can plead guilty, but they can't have a trial. But frankly, given, you know, what a morass Guantanamo has been, if the deal was that you could plead guilty in exchange for a very notional sentence, then this might provide an alternate way for people to get home from Guantanamo. And apparently the draft legislation actually even suggests that the individuals could then serve their sentences in their home countries. And that's fairly standard in criminal law for countries to sentence an individual and then allow them to go and serve the sentence in the home country where they can have family visits, where potentially there might be some rehabilitation support systems in place. But it is unprecedented to have a situation where someone could be charged but could only plead guilty and not have a trial. But it kind of just highlights how totally bizarre and totally unique everything to deal with Guantanamo is.
So how many have been tried?
So far, a total of 8 people have been through the military commission process in, you know, a decade and a half. 9 people have died at Guantanamo. 8 have been through the military commission process. And of those 8, 6 cop pleas essentially as their only way to get out of Guantanamo. So you can hardly say that those were legitimate convictions. Of the 2 individuals that were tried, one was Hamdan, the guy that was responsible for the first Supreme Court challenge, And he got what essentially was a 5-month sentence and went home. So just a slap on the hand. The other was a guy called Al-Balul, who was a propagandist for Osama bin Laden. But he wanted to be represented by a lawyer from his own country. The government refused, so he boycotted his trial. And so there was no defense mounted whatsoever. He got a life sentence, but his charges are still pending in the D.C. Circuit, where we've been waiting for many months for the latest decision as to whether his conviction for conspiracy is valid or not.
This is Jonathan Havers. I just wanted to just add one thing. I think David Glazer's excellent point about the guilty plea proposal, the plea guilty and be able to serve your sentence elsewhere but not be able to request a trial. I think it's a positive way or device to try to get around all the legal morass or escape the legal morass like Guantanamo is. But it's worth reminding ourselves how just shows how ludicrous Guantanamo is. I mean, if you could imagine, right, like the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II, right, which are the kind of the origin of the modern war crimes trial. If the defendants who were going to be put on trial for their crimes were given a choice not of a trial, but said you could plead guilty if you want, or you could spend the rest of your life in detention because the war's not over, it wouldn't have had a lot of legitimacy. And I think that's it. Just the notion that this is actually a step forward in terms of the Guantanamo situation just shows how incredibly warped the system has become.
Jonathan Hafet, so if there have been so few trials and so many have now been released after this long detention with no trial, meaning likely there was no legitimate charge, and yet they've spent years of their lives incarcerated in this place and now have been released with no compensation and no rehabilitation. I imagine these people are pretty damaged from this entire process. What do you know about that?
I think that's true, that a number of them are. I think it varies. I think that everybody is different and that they handle it in different ways, and that some are better able to adapt. I certainly think that I don't think every prisoner, every person would have to be affected and affected significantly by the odyssey on treatment at Guantanamo, kind of being put in this prison that's different than any other prison, right? Where you're not tried, you're not convicted and given a sentence, right? But you're sort of held outside the law, and then you're given some minimal legal process, but that's a kind of imprisonment that's far more kind of political than legal. I think everyone will be affected by that, but I think that some detainees are better able to deal with it. I think it depends on the person, on the supports they have when they go home in their life. So I think everyone is scarred. Some are able to address it, to sort of compensate more successfully than others. That's been my experience.
Peter Honigsberg, you're probably the expert on this with your project. What would you say to this?
Well, I have to say, I think everyone was very much impacted by it. And I think that I agree with Jonathan, some people perhaps more than others. I think anyone who did not go to their home country had it much worse because they had no support system. Believe it or not, they sent some people to countries where there are no mosques, no Muslim population, so they had no community to really rely on at all, even in a foreign country. Those who did go home did have a more support system. One of the real problems with that is that many of the families that we discovered did not want to hear the stories of the men when they came home. They felt the men are home, now they should move on with their lives, which might sound logical to the families and perhaps to us, but in fact to the men, until they've had an opportunity to actually go through what I believe a necessary therapy and counseling on what they experienced, I don't think their lives can just move on that easily. I mean, it is true, people back, they say, from World War II and maybe Vietnam came back as soldiers and never told about their experiences and moved on with their lives. But I think people do need to speak about it and do need to just have a therapeutic counseling on that. And I think as long as they don't, maybe they move on with their lives, but I'm not sure that it doesn't come back to haunt them in certain ways. I don't know. We didn't interview all of them, but I think it is very complicated. And I think anybody who's gone through that experience, especially when they've just been picked up and purchased by the U.S. government, thrown into this cell and kept there without charges for some period of time, and they need a lot more than really being sent home. And again, many of the people were never sent home and will never go home and will have no support system.
I've interviewed people from some of the countries where they've been released back, and I know that once there has been a psychological effect, there's also a stigma attached to it. I wonder, do you know anything about their dealing with stigma?
Well, I do think many of the people refused to talk to us because they didn't want the community to know that they were in Guantanamo. And actually, one person did talk to us on condition we don't put his name on our website. No one knows we interviewed him until some future date, because he was afraid that if his mosque and community knew that he was in Guantanamo, he would lose his employment and all his support system. So yes, there is a real stigma attached to many of the men who did go back.
There are a couple of other things that you wrote about. One is, you're reminding me of this because you had phrased this like they were disappeared for their families. They were disappeared people. And if they don't want anybody to know they were in Guantanamo, that continues that idea of having been disappeared. There are all kinds of legal issues around that, but also regular pragmatic issues.
Well, you're going back to a time when the U.S. government did not release the names of the people that they held in Guantanamo until various issues, I don't need to go into this, little complicated, 2005. And so not all families knew that their sons, husbands, fathers were in Guantanamo. Some heard from people who were released. Some heard through lawyers or actually from the countries themselves. But some people never heard. And so those people, and actually everyone was disappeared, and some people were disappeared for years, and families did not know what happened to their loved ones. So yes, that is true. And when families did find out, not everyone accepted it, of course.
You and Jonathan were talking about the resettlement, and if they can't be resettled in their home countries, and I remember one of your articles, Peter, dealt with the Uyghurs who couldn't go back to China because of the potential torture, and they ended up getting resettled. I think it was in Bermuda or something. There are all kinds of issues related to how to resettle them as well that gets tied into this.
Absolutely, and actually the Uyghurs are a sad case because they were resettled in a number of countries. And one of the countries that wanted to take them and going to take them was Palau, which has a population of 20,000. There was no employment for 6 Uyghurs to think of and had no future at all. Ultimately, they all got out. I can't tell you where they went. One did go to Turkey, but it is sad.
David Glazer, where do we go from here? And what happens if we get a Hillary Clinton presidency, or if we get a Donald Trump presidency, and there's this slim possibility of a Bernie Sanders presidency? How do you see this going from here till the end of the Obama administration? How do you see it going with the potential candidates?
Not well. I have to say that my personal concern is probably a bit different from most folks on this. In other words, what I'm most concerned with is seeing the detention grounded in a sustainable rule of law. Now, I am actually a little bit unique, perhaps among many of the commentators, in that I'm willing to concede that the United States does remain in an armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and could continue to hold a small number of individuals who are clearly associated with Al-Qaeda in preventive detention if it did so in a way that was consistent with the law of war. I mean, there's so many things wrong with Guantanamo, from the fact that many of the people are held by mistake to the fact that it's based on a prison. And if you want to hold people preventively based on the law of war, you can't hold them in a prison cell. It has to be sort of the classic prisoner of war camp model. So essentially everything is wrong with the detention there. But the current plans to close Guantanamo, which have seemed to involve considering some small number of people too dangerous to release, and the idea that has already been touched upon, moving them to a maximum security prison in the United States, actually makes their conditions of detention worse and doesn't do anything at all to help the legal situation. I am concerned, though, that I don't have any reason to believe that any of the leading candidates for president at this point care any more about getting the law right. And I'm worried that they are potentially more susceptible to political pressures to make things worse and to allow us to detain further people, because the U.S. is supposedly fighting a number of terrorist groups around the world. And people have been calling for, you know, detaining members of ISIS, for example, that are captured. So I'm not optimistic for things to get better. And I think that as a lame duck president who doesn't have any politics to worry about, if there's any hope to make forward progress, it has to happen before Obama leaves office, because a new president is going to be very unlikely to expend political capital on behalf of a relatively small number of foreign detainees who most Americans erroneously still believe are the worst of the worst. One of the things that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is, you know, when we started this process a couple of years ago, as you mentioned, we were down to like 166. And most people at least believe that, okay, well, now at least we must really be getting close to these guys being the worst of the worst. But these few review boards that have taken place have been clearing the detainees for release at something like a 75% or better rate. These are the last, you know, couple dozen folks at Guantanamo, and they're still being cleared at this very, very high rate. So even today, the folks that are there cannot be fairly considered to be the worst of the worst. A substantial number are still people who we never should have been holding in the first place.
Seems like it's a real black mark on the United States to have held erroneously so many people for so long. Jonathan Heifetz?
I think that's true. It's not good for the United States standing. But, you know, the U.S. government and President Obama, McCain, when he was running in 2008 as well, recognized this and had said that this undermines the United States' reputation. It makes the fight against terrorism more difficult. And Obama's been very clear, I think, in conveying that message, or fairly clear, but they've just simply not taken the steps to address it. I mean, so I think there is a concern with, you know, Guantanamo sort of remaining there as being a something that becomes a place that a rallying cry for radical groups. And I think it also undermines the United States' ability to advocate for human rights globally, you know, not only in the fact that the United States is still holding prisoners there, but also in the failure to provide compensation and redress. So human rights law is very clear that you have to give people who've been abused by and mistreated by your officials some ability to obtain compensation, and the failure and the resistance of the United States to that, you know, it undermines its ability to advocate for human rights globally. So, I mean, in so many ways, Guantanamo is counterproductive to this country.
How do you see us going from here, Jonathan, in terms of like what can be done at this point? What makes the most sense? And given that there is going to be a new president come next year?
I think there's what should be done and what can be done. What's realistic. I think they're quite different, or there's a big gulf between them, unfortunately. So I share the skepticism that David has expressed. I think that the Obama administration needs to make a push and do everything to close the prison. I mean, unfortunately, the administration has maintained the law of war detention and military commissions, which are going to make it difficult to fully close the prison. And I think one of the paradoxes is as the population gets a little bit smaller, it makes it, in a sense, there's less political pressure to do something. So I worry that, you know, the administration will say, we made progress. We reduced the population. We've complied with international law, which I don't think is accurate. And that they'll, in a sense, defused at least partly some of the controversy over Guantanamo, but that the prison is still going to be there.
Jonathan, I wonder if you could also address the concerns about the incoming president.
I think a Sanders presidency would certainly recognize the economic folly of Guantanamo, if nothing else, where it costs multiple times the amount of money to hold someone at Guantanamo that it does somewhere else. But between those two more likely candidates, I think it would depend. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think the best that you can hope for is almost the status quo. I think under a Trump presidency, who knows, but things could get a lot worse. I mean, I would expect potentially an effort to try to bring more prisoners into Guantanamo. Whereas I think Clinton, I would hope at least, would sort of continue with the attrition that Obama has pursued. I'm not terribly optimistic they'll make a whole lot of headway towards closing it, or Hillary Clinton is going to have any incentives to really feel the need to take a bold step to close it. But I will hope, and through the pressure that will be applied from her base, that she's not going to at least reverse course and try to, you know, revive Guantanamo.
So in a sense, it's almost like the best option is kind of a continuation of the current policy, which leaves a good deal to be desired.
Peter?
I just want to add, it's really important what Jonathan said. It's really important to understand that even President Obama acknowledges what a black mark Guantanamo is. And one of the things that we find when we interview people is that people around the world see Guantanamo, keep pointing to it as a symbol of where America has fallen and where America used to stand for human rights and rule of law. And Guantanamo, they point to and say, you are no longer the bastion of human rights and rule of law because of Guantanamo. And I don't think Americans understand that. Americans don't really pay attention to that, but everyone else in the world does, and they constantly point to it. And until Americans understand how important Guantanamo is as a symbol of what the rest of the world sees in America, it's just really not going to change. And that's why it's so critical that we close it and not just move the prisoners to the U.S., but to actually close it down and tell the world we understand we made a mistake and we really do believe in human rights and rule of law. And that message, I think Obama understands, but he hasn't followed through on it. And I think other people, Americans, need to understand that.
Peter, one other thing that you've written about and advocated for is a truth commission. How do you see that?
I wrote about that in the early days. I was hoping for something like that, but I certainly don't see that anymore. I mean, Obama made it very clear he's looking forward and not backward. And I can't imagine that any of the new people who are running for president now will raise a truth commission and look backward either. I just don't see it, unfortunately. Maybe in a generation or two, someone will finally acknowledge what we did and what we did wrong. But whether there'll be a truth commission even then, I can't say. But certainly it's not going to happen presently, no.
David Glazier, final remark?
I wish there was reason for optimism, but we'll see. But I don't see a lot to be cheerful about here.
Thank you to all three of you, David Glazier, Jonathan Heifetz, and Peter Honigsberg. Thank you so much for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle. Great to have you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
David Glazier is a professor of law at Loyola Law School. His publications include Destined for an Epic Fail, The Problematic Guantanamo Military Commissions, and The Misuse of History, Conspiracy and the Guantanamo Military Commissions. Peter Jan Honigsberg is professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. He's the founder and director of the Witness Guantanamo Project and the author of Our Nation Unhinged, The Human Consequences of the War on Terror and Crossing Border Street, a Civil Rights Memoir. Jonathan Heifetz is a human rights lawyer and a professor at Seton Hall Law School. He's the author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and he's co-editor of The Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.